So if you can pass that back, if you're planning to take the course for credit, please sign in. Material about the course is on the course webpage, which is courses.washington.edu/MEBI590. Basically, you get one free miss a quarter. Doesn't mean you have to take your free miss. It means you can if you get sick or you get a snow day or whatever. And the full schedule of lectures for the whole quarter is available there as well. Any questions about the course itself for the folks who are new to the class? All right. So it's my pleasure to welcome Jim Brinkley to the class. Jim is one of the founding informatics researchers at the University of Washington. He's got a math, medical, and medical computer engineering background. There's more information on his background on the bio paragraph. And pass that around. So I won't belabor that part. I will just say that Jim is nationally, internationally recognized for his work, in particular his work on structural informatics, which is a term he coined now 2 decades ago. 2 decades of structural informatics. There you go. You could have retitled this thing, 2 decades of structural informatics.
That's a good thing or bad.
And Jim's going to present an overview of the work going on in the structural informatics research group and current projects and anticipated future projects. So without further ado, Jim, have at it.
I might want to move this slightly here just so I can get around to do it.
Is that okay?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks everybody for coming. I've been doing this every year, actually, so this is just a kind of an update on what we've been doing over the last year. But I know I see a lot of you that weren't in my talks last year, so I'll give you the overview first. I want to start out with there's a kind of an emerging shared vision in the world now of creating a worldwide network of integrated data and knowledge, but bring the relevant information to the point of need. Of course, this is highly true in biomedicine, translation of medicine, fostering translation of basic research to the bedside, from the bench to the bedside. And so what the long-term goals of the structural informatics group, that, as Peter said, has been going on for about 20 years, is to contribute to this shared vision by building a structural information framework for biomedicine and use that as a basis for organizing a lot of this biomedical information that will be part of this larger worldwide network. And so why do we approach that? The rationale for that is that the structure of the body I would think would be the most, and a lot of people think, is the most useful means for organizing biomedical information. It's why John Clark there teaches anatomy first to the medical student when they first arrive. It's the first class they take, because it not only is it necessary to understand anatomy just for learning medicine, it's just a good way to organize other things on top of it. So, and most manifestations of health and disease are properties of anatomical entities. So if you can really understand your anatomy, you can really understand a lot about how the body works. And so that leads to the informatics research questions that we're trying to deal with. How do you create a structural information framework that represents the structure of the body? And how do you use that framework as a basis for organizing information? Those are the primary things we've been working on. So our approach that we've been working on, again, as Peter said, for about 20 years, is to basically start by classifying, understanding the types of structural information that there are, then represent these different classes and types in different modules that are integrated or tied together over a distributed framework. Now, this distributed framework we've actually been thinking about for 20 years, way before the web or service-oriented architectures. And so it's sort of all this way we've been doing it is naturally fed into the more modern stuff with semantic web and service-oriented architectures, web services. And we've also been developing applications opportunistically, depending, of course, on funding and research interests and collaborators, what students are involved in it. A lot of that depends on what we do, depends on who's involved in it. But all these applications drive these underlying methods to build this structural framework. So the current driving biological applications, which I'll spend a little more time on a little bit later, we started out actually with anatomy education. Cornelius Ross taught anatomy here for 30 years, and I guess more than that. And he's the one who brought me up here. His primary interest was always in anatomy education. And that still is, we're doing that still with a project with the ISIS group here. Then later on, we got involved in the National Human Brain Project, which is an attempt to organize information about the brain. And so we did a lot of stuff with organizing brain imaging data, brain mapping data, and we're still doing that with the IBIC group, and also Nolan Nichols here is working on that. Proteomics is fairly recent through the ITHS, basically. In other ways, we're actually running a neuroproteomics bioinformatics center here in our group. And clinical trials, a lot lately through the Institute of Translational Health Sciences, ITHS, where Peter is the head of the informatics core, and I'm an associate director, helping people manage their data for that. And then also working with Linda Shapiro, Michael Cunningham, and others at Children's, working on understanding craniofacial malformations. And the nice problem about that one is it's a perfect example of genotype-phenotype correlations. If we can understand and characterize craniofacial abnormalities, their problem is to understand the genetic causes. And it's a perfect structural problem for us to be thinking about.
All these are related to have some various funding and different people working on them.
So all those, though, tie into these basic research themes. How do you build a structural framework? And then how do you use it to manage data, to integrate data, and to visualize data? Those are the main informatics areas that I'm personally interested in and that we've moved in that direction over the years. So now, those are the sort of general overview. And now what I'm going to do is talk about the main projects we're working on in this group, starting with the foundational model of anatomy, then talking about views over the foundational model of anatomy, data, and then these various parts, areas where we're doing this management, integration, visualization of data. So the FMA, Foundational Model of Anatomy, started out actually was by Cornelius Ross, and then Onar Mahino is the current one who's been working on that, and Todd Detweiler's been a major part of that, doing all the technical aspects of it, and Nolan over here is doing a lot of it also for neuroconnectivity. Basically, what the FMA is an ontology, and I don't know that everybody here knows what an ontology is. It's basically, if you think about anatomy as an example, you think about two kinds of anatomy, where we classify the kinds of information. One is the spatial information, the images, the 3D models, and illustrations that you see in the text. But the other is the text associated with the images, like the names of things and their relationships. So anytime you open an anatomy textbook or an atlas, you're going to see those two things. So what this is trying to represent what's in the text. And you need that in order to, and there's the guy right there who's building it, those two. Just private. We're talking about the FMA. So that's Onar Mahino and Todd Detweiler, who are the main developers of this thing. So the idea of the text is in that text in the book, it talks about these are the names of the things, this is what's connected to this, this is what the branches of this are. So that's the deep knowledge that you're trying to learn when you learn anatomy, not just the images. So how do you represent that? That's the question. That's what this is trying to do. So we give an example here of the right ventricle of the heart. And what the way you have all these well-defined names for things, that's the first step, is to get standardized names. And then you want to have relationships among those names. And there are different kinds of relationships you might want to have. This is the most central one. It's called the anatomy taxonomy. And we said that the right ventricle is a cardiac chamber, which is an organ region, which is an organ part, which is an anatomical structure. That's a classification hierarchy that lets you say what kind of thing it is. And if you know what it is, you can infer a lot of things about it. And these aren't exactly the right things now, but this is the basic idea. These things slightly change. But you can also say that the right ventricle is bounded by the sternocostal surface, which is a surface. You can say that the sternocostal surface is bounded by the right coronary sulcus. You can say that the right ventricle has adjacency. It's adjacent to the left ventricle. It's inferior to the diaphragm. So all these kind of relationships. In fact, the FMA has how many types of relationships? Well,
174.
174 different types of relationships. I'm only showing you about three here. It's got tell me all the numbers. You know what? How many concepts these days?
It's about 80,000.
84,000 and change.
Yeah, and over those are instantiated in about 2 million relationships, something like that.
Yeah. More, about 2.2.
So it's one of the largest ontologies there is right now, actually, in biomedicine. That creates its own problems in informatics. We're actually building it in a tool called Protege, which was developed at Stanford, and we have a lot of collaboration with Stanford, partly because I was there before, but also because they're doing a lot of really good work with ontologies. They have a center, National Center for Biomedical Ontology. So this is just this anatomical taxonomy. It's kind of like Windows. You could open it up and close it. And so if you open up one of these things, looking at the anatomical entity of the different subclasses, organ, subclasses of organ, this is an organ with organ cavity, one particular one is the esophagus. This is the sort of hierarchy here. And if you click on that, you get the so-called frame associated with it. It tells you all the information about the esophagus, such as its definition, what are its synonyms,
whether it's non-English equivalents. We have a unique ID for all these things, a preferred name for it, which you can change if you want to use that name. But it's part of some different kinds of part of relationships. So there's different orientations. There's a lot of information to be stored about this, which allows us then to do later on some reasoning. So it's stored in Protégé, and actually it's one of the most influential in terms of how useful it is. It's the actually, depending on what day of the week you do this, you do a Google Scholar search for biomedical informatics in quotes, this often is the number one hit on this thing. So it's have been very influential in informatics research, and right now there are this is the canonical paper by Cornelius Ohnert basically describing this thing. So it's at least 500 articles are citing it. And mostly what it's led to is informatics research. It's not as widely used, in fact, hardly at all, in actual education, as John would know very well. But because nobody wants to see that. No student wants to see that. So a challenge is, how do you put this under the hood and let it help you teach it? And that's something we have not solved. But in terms of informatics, the fact that it's so large, it's so complete, has led to all sorts of interesting informatics research.
Has anyone else done the same thing?
A lot of people are doing ontologies, and a lot of people have done anatomy ontologies, but I think Ohnert would agree with me, nobody's done anything this complete.
Right. There are some earlier attempts before, but not as comprehensive or extensive.
In fact, what's happening is nowadays, lots of people that already have some anatomy part of their ontology are using the FMA now. They're adapting to fit the FMA. And I'll show you a couple examples of that. Neuro is a good example. We're doing a lot with neuro. So, and in fact, you know Doug Bowden? We incorporated his work on that.
Yes, I'm just wondering the extent to which you're using the FMA to reach out and go beyond the current texts that are the TA, Terminologica, Anatomica, the historic one of the sources that contributed to FMA, but that when you try to tell people what FMA is, they go back and say, well, it should be TA, and TA is years behind. So I was kind of curious, in your educational thing, what steps you might be taking along that
to educate people about the use of the FMA?
How the FMA is much more extensive and much more valuable and much more systematic than the older.
I think that's happening. Actually, it's already happening. He spends almost all his time on conferences and workshops, people are trying to use the FMA because they recognize that now, including TA, I think, with the terminology I talked about. But that's, it takes time. And again, most people don't want to see that. They want to see something more like you see in a textbook, and that's a challenge. That's part of what I'll talk about in a minute. So what are we doing with the FMA right now? This is a perfect example of the influence of it. We're using it to reorganize the neuroanatomic atlas, the neuroanatomy axis of Radlex. Now, what's Radlex? It's a radiological ontology that is developed by the Radiological Society of North America to organize their, if they do radiology reporting, they want to be able to organize their reports and make sure they use standard terminology. So they developed this thing, but it started out as just the terminology, and they realized they have to extend it to be more precise and more well-organized. And so we're working with them on a subcontract with Stanford to actually extend the FMA for neuroanatomy and then extract a piece of it and use that to organize Radlex. We're also doing something similar with Radlex to incorporate lymphatics so we can predict the spread of cancer somewhat automatically. That's based on some previous work with the Ira Calla axis. And representing neural connectivity. There's a lot of work on the so-called connectome project out there to try to map the connections in the brain. We're working with a lot of people to try to define a lot of the white matter tracks in there. And Nolan's done a lot of that, and Ohnert are doing those things. So there's a lot of work with those things. These were just presented at the last American Medical Informatics Association conference. This is Ohnert's poster on reorganizing Radlex, and I obviously won't go into detail on what that looks like. The other one is we're incorporating the lymphatics into the FMA. So you can see that's why we have so much stuff in there. There's very, very detailed with synonyms and the ideas that clinicians can use this to really help predict cancer spread and use it for their reporting. So we're working again with radiologists actually to talk to
measure. So question, is that figure from a publication?
Yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah, Ohnert is. Well, go ahead, Ohnert. How are you doing that?
Oh no, I just used the. This is just a PowerPoint slide. It's not part of the Protégé.
Okay.
Tool. It would be nice to have the images, a plugin for images, and We've always wanted something like that.
So a lot of this is money. You know, if you have the right, we know exactly what to do. It's just a matter of.
But the point of that image is, I would go to one of the numbers and click on it for information.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I can show you that. We have something like that already, the digital anonymous atlases, where you have images, you click on it, and you get the name. But we had, in some experimental things, we hooked those up to the FMA. That's not, you know, production level.
Okay, so if I'm a clinician looking at a patient, I get radiology of this area, I go to my website, I can pull up the model for this area and look at normal anatomy or normal, the normal ontology for number 5, for example. Is that what I can do?
You could be able to. We haven't done that yet. Yeah, that would be applying this idea. But this is all kind of in the background right now.
Right. Okay.
That would be the idea, yeah. And that's what they're trying to do with RELEX, actually. So here's representing neural connectivity that Nolan presented at AMIA also. Again, that's a big area of interest right now because of these connectome projects that try to map the connections in the brain. But you know, they're getting all this data from fusion tensor imaging, but how do you organize it? How do you keep track of it? How do you represent the fact that one DTI data set says one thing about a connectivity, another one says something else? So how do you figure out how to deal with that? So what are we trying to do with the FMA? It's been going on for quite a while, but just far, far, you know, 80,000, you'd think that'd be everything, but anybody who knows anatomy knows it's far from complete. And so one of the things we want to do is this is represented in something called protege frames, which is what I was looking at, but the world is moving to the semantic web, and the representation of that is called OWL, Web Ontology Language, in fact, the second version of it. And so we want to convert it to OWL2 because if we can do that, we can be much, much more part of the semantic web. That's actually a non-trivial problem. It's very complicated, especially something as large as this. So we've had actually some meetings with Stanford and people around the world trying to figure out how to do that. Got to get money to do it, as usual. That's the biggest problem. And then we're also using that as a basis for these kind of application ontologies because nobody wants to see this whole thing. They just want to see pieces of it for their lymphatic stuff or for their neural stuff. Everybody who looks at the FMA, the first thing they say is, whoa, that's too complicated. So how do you use it as a basis for creating the so-called application ones? And then how do you use it as a basis for reorganizing other ontologies? So that's the kind of things we're doing. Now I'm going to get into the idea of how do you actually make this thing useful next. This is the so-called Ontology Views project. This is a collaborative project with Stanford and their National Center for Biomedical Ontology. A lot of the people here are involved. Todd, sitting right there. Owner is here and somewhere on that list. Maybe you're not.
Not on the list.
Oh, well, you should be on the list. Sorry, Mark. And this is work with computer science, Dan Sushi in the database world, John Gennari, Dan Cook. And these are people at Stanford, Natasha Noet, Dan Wood, and Mark Hewson. The main person who did a lot of the work on this is Marianne Shaw, a computer science PhD student who did this for a thesis. And then Nikki Dell was another computer science student who worked on this for the visualization part of it, which I'll tell you about. So what is this problem here? What we call the FMA is what we call a reference ontology, like a reference book. It's meant to be used in a lot of different things, but it's way too large to use for practical use. So the question is, how can we make these reference ontologies practical for applications? And so the way we've approached this is we're working with a database group up in computer science, who's very well known, and Dan Sushi, that is. And so what we're doing is treating application ontologies as views over one or more reference ontologies, where a view uses the database concept of a view. I don't know how many of you have worked with a relational database. You can make a view as a query, and that view then makes it look like another table in the relationship in the relational database, as though it were just already there. It allows you to hide information to present only what you want to see to the user. So we're using the same idea. We create a query, a formal query, which I'll tell you about in a minute, that defines a transformation from one or more source ontologies to a target application ontology. So we can make a view that only pulls out, say, the neuron anatomy, or only pulls out the liver part. And that's defined by a query, and then when you run that query, the result looks like another ontology that you can query. And so the way we've done this, actually, Marianne, Todd, and Dan primarily, is extensions to the semantic web query language called Sparkle. Now the semantic web, this is going to be not interesting to a lot of biologists, but the Sparkle, the semantic, well, it might be though, it should be, because the semantic web is becoming the way that we tie together this global information network. You all know about the web, but the way you search on the web is by clicking on keywords, and it just takes you to another website. The computer, the web has no notion what all those keywords mean. The semantic web is meant to be built on top of the web to provide meaning. And the way the meaning is done is through these names and relationships, like is a part of, etc. And they are, the web is designed to be have this large ontology essentially distributed all over the world, over the web. And so you can navigate through that based on meaning rather than just on clicking on keywords. And it's evolving, and a lot of things are working in that area. A lot of biomedical resources are getting into that. And so it's beginning to evolve in what you might call a global database. But any database, you've got to be able to query it. And you don't use relational SQL, which is the query language for relational databases. You don't use that. You use something called Spark, semantic, I don't know what that stands for, semantic web query language, something like that. I think it's a recursive definition. Anyway, Sparkle is the query language for the semantic web, one part of it. But it wasn't good enough, it wasn't rich enough for us to be able to create views. We want to be able to do something like on semantic web by finding the parts of the heart, and then parts of those parts, the parts of those parts, and those parts, the so-called transitive closure. You can't do that with Sparkle yet. And so Marianne extended that to add, and this is something Todd did, is allowing you to do these recursive queries. This is add a so-called regular path library. Subqueries, recursive queries, scaling functions, these are all things that are added to Sparkle to make it more usable in creating views. Here's the idea of a Sparkle query. This is kind of fluff here, the header, but what you're really trying to do here, I want to find all the regional parts of the liver. That's really what this is doing. And that's a kind of part along our, whatever you said, 200 different types of parts. What did you say? How many types of parts did you say? How many types of relationships? 175. But this is just one of those 175 estimated regional. So we want the regional parts of the liver, and the answers are regional part is the right lobe and the left lobe. Well, pretty simple. So that's, you're asking a question in the FMA to find that. And what Marianne's added is the ability to make this a little subquery, so you can have all these subqueries that can build up. And you can't do that on Sparkle. That's one thing she's added. And then another thing is a so-called recursive query, which allows you to do much more complicated queries. It's a pretty common thing done in computer science, but again, it's not done in the standard Sparkle. And so with a recursive query, you can get the so-called transitive closure, where you say, first give me the immediate regional parts of the liver, left lobe and right lobe. Then find me the here you're adding on to that. Find me the parts of those parts, and then find the parts of those and those, etc. So you're kind of expanding this sort of seed outward. And that's what this recursive query is doing. And the answer then is not just the direct parts, but it's all the parts, at least that are represented in the FMA. It doesn't mean they're all the parts that exist. And it's also the regional parts. There's other kinds of parts that we aren't showing. Because I know I could see your puzzle look, John. There's a lot more than that.
Actually, the puzzle look was there are four lobes to the liver. And I see the two, the left and right, and then the other two are in this right side column, quadrate and the caudate. So that was why I was wondering how it's classified.
Let's see. I'm not sure.
We can talk about
that. This is kind of a list of, it's a kind of a, you might say a graph. These are triples. This liver has regional part left lobe of the liver. Then the left lobe of the liver, wherever it is, has regional part caudate lobe. Then caudate lobe has, it's kind of a, it's just kind of a, what it's called a graph. And so you have a node, edge, falling all over. Think of neurons in the brain connected by. Yeah.
Does someone sit down and decide these? Someone has to sit down and actually put, whatever is in the
room. 20 years. This is huge. And that's one of the challenges. How can we, what if he gets run over by a truck? And also, what if people don't agree with him?
Yeah,
the nice thing about the semantic web is it allows people to bring in different modules that if you have a different opinion about the way something is, you can bring in a different module. But there's some fundamental things that almost everybody agrees with. So that's what he's trying to put in there. And then the idea would be able to bring in different modules, different people in different parts of the world, and bring in theirs. It really matters for neural connectivity because there's, nobody really has
all experts like I consult John for the lens.
Yeah, the lens is in there, I think, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so that was just going to come out in January in the Journal of Biomedical Informatics, describing vSparkle, and that's actually a big deal for us to get that in that journal. So that's if you're just looking at this here,
That's even that. It's a very simple query actually, but it's nobody who wants to see that. So even I don't want to see that. Most
so
of the time.
V-Sparkle was developed here.
Yes, yes. That's Marianne Shaw's PhD thesis in computer science. They're working on this grant. And then, so what she's done in addition to that, this is also Amy last year, is to make it simpler for people to create these queries using graphical interfaces. This is one example of that. Which I won't go into detail, but trying to make it so that you don't have to type all these things in. And then another thing, so a lot of this, the effort now is to make it simpler to use this thing for ordinary mortals to use it. I mean, I don't know all this stuff very well, so I'd like to be able to use it more easily. So here's another thing that Marianne did. On top of Sparkle, Sparkle is very, it's kind of like an assembly language. We want to build a higher level language on top of it. So this is called intermediate language. And basically what it does is it encapsulates the kind of operations you would want to do on a view in much more a higher level a way of looking at it. So here's the FMA as an ontology, and you might want to do like extract the whole tree out of it as one operation. You might want to delete an edge or extract a whole bunch of edges. You might want to have another ontology. This is one by Dan Cook called the Ontology of Physics and Biology. You might want to extract information about that, and then you want to put these together and maybe union these. So if you want to extract, maybe Dan Cook is only dealing with pure physiology. The FMA is only dealing with pure structure. If you want to put them together to say blood flow in the aorta, which is flow is a physiology concept, blood is a structural concept, put those together, you can query across both of them. So this is just showing how much it doesn't seem obvious, but this is the intermediate language for extracting the entire recursive transitive parts of the liver. That's much simpler than the other description. And then Nikki Dell, for her Qualls project in computer science, created a graphical user interface over IML, which allows you to take different boxes and put them together in a sort of information flow path. And it actually works fairly well. And so you can run that, you can then see how that compiles. So you take that diagram, you can compile down to this IML, you can then run that query, it goes out to the services that Todd set up, and then it gives you actually the answers there, and then beyond that even, you can then visualize the results by showing the liver and its constitutional parts. This is constitutional instead of regional parts, a different kind of part. And then you can keep opening up these things and look at more detail. So this is the beginning, and it's a long way to go before we can really make it widely usable. But this problem of visualizing ontologies is a good one for any PhD student who wants to work on. So that's a lot of that. You can also add much more complex views. So this is our way of creating these complex views. So what are we doing with this? We still have to make them run faster. They don't run as fast as we'd like. We're evaluating on various use cases, which are in that journal paper. There are other kinds of query languages besides ours. And then we're implementing all these and storing them in a view query manager that Todd built, which we'll talk about in a minute. So that's a little bit about the ontology views idea. And then one of the questions is, how are you going to use that for various applications? Before I get to that, I want to talk more about the other big area. This is kind of a service part that we're doing, data management. Almost everybody, you talk to anybody, all they care about is managing their data. They don't care about most of the rest of this, and they shouldn't have to. All the rest should be under the hood. So for data management, this is done, Joshua Franklin, Sina Herzenberg, Ron Shaker, and Noel Nichols are all building different data management systems. In the past, we built a bunch of data management tools. In fact, one for John's eye group, one for George Ogeman in neurosurgery, various ones. And now we're taking some of these tools and other tools and are using those. And so the driving applications for that come from the ITHS. Everybody who does clinical trials needs to manage their data. The UW Neuroproteomics Center, as I said, Ron has built a data management system for them. And then the UW Interdisciplinary Brain Imaging Center, IBIC, they need to manage their data also. And so just some examples of what we've done. This is actually something we didn't build here. It's called REDCap. It came from Vanderbilt. It's an open source clinical trials data management system. So Joshua has installed that, and that's being used now by the ITHS for people to manage their clinical trials. And one particular place that's been used is one of our collaborators, Ann Stephen, at Children's, for managing lupus patients. So that's one thing just to keep. These are kind of things called case report forms, where you see a patient, and you have to click on, have to store various observations about the patient. But another thing that people do in clinical trials is they might draw samples.
blood samples or something like that, and they need to freeze those samples and put them somewhere and manage them. So that's kind of a freezer management problem. And for that, we couldn't find any free or easily installed system. So that Xenia, I think I saw her, there she is, it built one of those, built a little example of a freezer lab management system called R-Lab, because it's written in Ruby on Rails. And that's actually been installed. Both of these have been installed at Ann Stevens' lab. And they were so happy with it, you can't see this, they invited us to a baby shower to at their house, where they inaugurated the installation of RedCap and R-Lab, and they gave us little red hats with R's on them. Actually, I thought that was great. I mean, it's so nice to actually do something useful that people actually like. And so what we want to do is generalize these things and make them usable for a lot of other people. RedCap already is, but R-Lab needs to be generalized. Another thing that Xenia is working on is through Paul Fern is something called CA Tissue, which is part of the CA Big project at NCI to manage cancer data. This is an open source tissue management and biorepository software that we're installing, but it's way, way more complicated than our lab, but as Nina can attest. But it is a potential to allow you to share a biorepository data, not just individual lab data, but discarded samples, things like that across the country. And there's a lot of interest in ITHS doing that. The Neuroproteomics Center is what Ron's built. He actually adapted a tool from the East Research Center, and now we have a system to manage your proteomics data. And he's working on right now, what he's working on right now is this is for protein interactions. So he's working on now a tool for visualizing protein interactions and extending Peter's biomediator system so you can query across multiple proteomics related databases out there on the web and then bring them together and then look at the protein interactions. So there's a lot going on with that. And Nolan's working with IVIC on something called XMAP. This is a open source tool for managing DICOM images for radiology. So that's another tool that we're involved with IVIC on. And so those are all a lot of the data management challenges are what we've been working on. There's always challenges for data management, whether you build versus buy, because if you buy, you know, it's theoretically cheaper, but then you have to still have the people to manage them, and you don't always get what you want. Lots of reasons for that. Also, that most of the commercial systems don't allow you to incorporate common terminology for later data integration, which is something you want to do. Eventually, the idea is that you want to manage your own data, but with the idea that later on you might want to share it and integrate it. So if you're going to do that, you've got to use these ontologies to organize. And this is a big one. How do you reduce the time to develop custom applications? And if you could solve that, probably could make a lot of money. So Microsoft hasn't done it yet either. So a lot of people just use Excel. More for that reason. It's just too much trouble to try to build one yourself and too expensive. So then we got all these data management systems out there. We've got the RedCap, we've got RLab, we've got this is the Proteomics Center, we've got various other ones, XNAP. So now we've got all these data systems, and how do we link it into it? And how do we do that? One way we do it is through these ontologies, the FMA, for example. So one way, let's see. I guess what I didn't show here is because it's not a major project right now, is the idea of if we're going to link these together with ontologies, what we want to do is build tools to annotate the data with the terms from the ontologies. So we've actually built tools for annotating images where you draw a contour on an image, and then you select from a list of possible names from the ontology, and then that allows you to associate a name with a region on an image. And that's the general idea of annotation. It's used for genes. You know, use gene ontology for annotating genes. If you can annotate the data with common terms from ontologies, then later on you can do data integration. We are doing some of that, but I don't show it here. So then, but I do want to get into the notion of data integration. This is work with mostly Todd and Joshua Franklin and Ron Schaefer. And it's an approach, there's a lot of different approaches for data integration. NIH really wants us to share our data these days. Actually, and you have to write if you're over 500,000 if you're going to share your data, but actually most people don't. It's too complicated. Nobody knows really how to do it, really. And there are a lot of big efforts to do data integration. One of them is called the CA Big project. It's huge amounts of money going into that. Another one's called the Biomedical Informatics Research Network, BIRN. There's a lot of these consortium that are trying to share data. But it's still a hard problem. And so there are different approaches. One of them is the one Peter has done for years, Biomediator, a so-called mediated approach.
The approach that we're taking here is called lightweight distributed queries. And this is, you're not going to read this, obviously, but this is the this is a lightweight distributed query. And what it's doing is it's a query that allows you to go out to these different sources, like XNAT, like RedCap, like RLAB, make a query across those and bring all the data together. And the key element that's required is it uses XML, which is the data exchange language for the web, in order to tie things together. So as long as your source can produce XML, then this thing can access it. That's why we call it lightweight, because it's very easy to bring in another source. It has its own problems, among which is, how can you ever build that? So there are definite problems for this. But it does, we have used it in the past, which I presented before, for integrating brain data. And just you can basically see if we can make a query and it can display those the results of functional data mapped onto the brain in only a certain part of the brain, because we use the FMA to figure out which part of the brain we're looking at. I didn't talk about this year because I talked about that a lot last year. So the other thing that I wanted to talk about briefly is the View Query Manager by Todd. And the idea here is that we want to build a tool for creating and managing and querying views over the web. I mentioned the whole idea is that we have this generalized global database that's evolving using the web and the semantic web. And there are lots of different web representations out there. There's HTTP, which I'm not even talking about because it's not really designed to be read by computers so much. But XML, I think most of you probably heard of it. It's the data exchange language over the web. There's then under the semantic web is RDF, which is built on XML, and OWL, which is built on XML. RDF is the semantic web, these triple things that you can use to tie information together. OWL is the web ontology language, which I briefly mentioned before. And because there's so many different representations, there are also lots of different query languages. There's Sparkle, there's New Sparkle with Readbuild, there's XQuery, which is the query language for XML, and then there's this is a query language for OWL. And actually, we've built something called Brain Product called Distributed XQuery, DXQuery. So there are lots of different query and representations, lots of different query languages, but there is one common foundation, which is XML. So the idea here is that any system, we want to be able to build a tool that can allow you to manage these views and these queries over any of these systems and allow you to choose the sources and the query language and then build up queries over queries so we can tie things together. So this is what actually Todd has built. Now, and this is an example of the query manager. So this is a paper actually was published where we're looking at over Bern, which is one of these consortiums, and we collected a lot of data about schizophrenics, and we want to look at healthy versus schizophrenics at functional MRI activations that are confined to a specific region of the brain. And again, it's a very complicated query, but what it's doing is it's going after these different sources, and it's also embedding a query to the FMA to say, I want to only find those activations that are in the temporal lobe of the brain. Well, the way they're annotated is by parts of the temporal lobe. So it first goes to the FMA and says, what are the parts of the temporal lobe? And then for each one of those parts, it goes and finds out whether the functional activation is in that part. And then it only retains, although it's a long query, it only retains those, and then it allows you to visualize it on a 3D model. And so that's using a language we call DXQuery that we developed, but you can have other languages. You can have Sparkle, vSparkle, and any other ones. So that's the idea, is to put all these together, be able to search queries, manage them, and then use it for various applications. So this is one of those queries. This allows you, this is part of it. We're working with NCBO, at Stanford, National Center for Biomedical Ontology. These are all their ontologies that they're storing. We can now search over all those and bring them in to our query manager. We're working with Ida Sim at UCSF on something, an ontology of clinical research, OCR. And one of the things they want to do with OCR is create common terms they use to annotate case report form data in something like REDCap. That is, again, annotation. If you want to do that, you want to grab a set of standard terms from an ontology and then use those in your application. So this is one. This is called the telecommunication scheme. And I think if you run this, yeah, this gives you the different telecommunication schemes, telephone, mail to fax, HTTP. That's, you know, all you really care about in your application is this little stuff here. So if you were trying to write a form that described how you did something, you just have a pull-down list, and all it would have would be these text pieces here. So some application would call this service, and it's, for those of you who care about it, this is called a REST service, which is basically a URL. You call that directly, and it produces this. Your application can eat that, consume it,
and then just generate a pick list of when you're annotating your data. So it's a way to get common terms for annotating your data. So what do we, I think this query manager, although it may not sound like it, it ties together almost everything we've been doing for a long time, and I'm pretty interested in it. We're interested in doing a lot of work with this, bringing in additional query languages. There's OWL query languages that we haven't looked at, building graphical user interfaces, building better ways to visualize results. So if you have brain mapping data, you want to visualize them on a 3D brain. If you've got ontology data, you want to visualize them on a graph. If you have another thing that I'll get to in a minute, if you have anatomic three-dimensional models, you want to visualize those in a 3D viewer. You also want to be able to create views over views, so you can kind of tie, instead of tying together information through just URLs like everybody's used to, you want to tie them together through queries. So queries over queries over queries might be a way to glue together this large global database. And this is part of our deliverable. We have to send this off to Stanford. So finally, I'll just give you some work on visualization. This is part of the ISIS project, Institute of, I don't know how to pronounce it. Do you know what that stands for, Don?
Surgical simulation.
Yeah, it's basically the simulation center in the Department of Surgery. Basically, it's the idea of a flight simulator for surgery and other things, so that you got to practice before you can go out and do surgery, which makes a lot of sense. And so, but part of that, we've got a project with them to build what we call the intelligent virtual cadaver. The idea that you have a cadaver, a virtual cadaver, that would allow you to not replace, but augment the standard dissection, and then use that as a way to learn about your anatomy before you go into the dissecting room. Great advantage of a virtual cadaver is that you can put it back together again. If you make a mistake, you don't have to give up. And also, so what we call it intelligent because it's going to have associated with the names from the FMA, so it'll know its own anatomy. And then you can build anatomical scenes, and we've got some examples of that in the past. So I'll just show you, this is part of Wayne Warren's thesis, and now Tron Nelson comes from the HIT lab, actually, Human Interface Technology Lab, is going to be continuing with that project. So basically, this is a collaboration with ISIS, and it uses Wayne's program called BioLucida, which is a 3D scene generation program. It'll not only allow you to make 3D scenes of anatomy, but it's his thesis, which we'll talk about later, I hope, is to superimpose functional information like gene expression data on top of that, or functional MRI data on top of it. So here's a picture of the part of it. I guess we need some lights now. Can somebody just turn it on? Yes. These are a set of 3D models. Whoa, is there any more light? I can't even see the keyboard. Yeah, that's great, thanks. I still can't see it too well, but anyway, these are some models we actually bought from a company called Zygote. I think you've seen the newest Google 3D body. This is the same set of models. We've got them, bought them before at Google, but I think they can do a lot with them. So this is all 3D. You can rotate it around. Then I'll show you an example of that in a minute. The other thing that's new this year is that we also could go get 3D CT images from radiology, use a program called OSIRIX to extract out real anatomy from that, and then superimpose that real anatomy on the models. And so you can sort of, you can't see that at all, but basically the atlas images are behind that, and you can sort of superimpose these. So the idea is to not just get atlas models, but get real data, eventually merging them together and being able to use that for education and then for other things. This is some more pictures of it. Let me just show you if I can see if I can show you this thing running. So yeah, this is real 3D, and this is in a language called X3D, which is the successor to a language called DRML. So the web is all moving in the three-dimensional direction, and so what we're moving towards is being able to click on these things, get names from the FMA, be able to automatically generate certain views of this thing and be able to take it apart, put it back together for education, and then later on for communicating other kinds of data. Okay, I guess I can have the lights again. Thanks. Okay.
Jim?
Yeah.
For those 3D models, the canonical image
is somehow bent or adapted to fit what you fetch, or is
so
it
you,
just...
So you saw right through the illusion. That is a fundamentally hard problem.
Yes.
And I worked on it for my thesis. I know how hard it is. And so what this all you did is do a simple affine transform and move it over. So the really hard problem is deforming the real patient to a canonical atlas. And that's so hard that I need somebody else solve it. We're assuming we got that solved. And we don't.
So it seems to me like the 3D image and the FMA are two separate things. It's not like you can generate one from the other.
That's right, absolutely.
So basically, you're going to have these two things, and then you're just going to draw connections between them and say, this is that.
No, that's the interesting part. It's actually it's the notion of annotations. If you have a 3D model, say, of the thalamus, and then associated with that is a name, thalamus, then the computer can automatically draw the line between the two. It's just that you have to have under the hood in your engine, in your computer engine, you have to know that there's an association between the word thalamus and the 3D picture of the thalamus. After you have that, the computer can put it all together. In fact, in our digital animus atlases, it does that all automatically. It draws pin diagrams automatically.
It's not just the word, it's you and I.
Yeah.
Right? So that means
what's a you and
I? Yeah, see,
it's a universal index. So it's more than just the word, it's actually the specific spot in the worldwide net.
It's a semantic web concept, but which we could talk about it. But it's more than a word. It carries meaning with it, not just letters.
Well, it's guaranteed to be unique in the world. Yeah. And it does that.
But you're way ahead of me.
Yeah, that doesn't matter.
I don't understand why that's important, but I'll talk to Jim about it.
Okay.
Okay. Can I?
Yeah.
So on the end,
I'm almost done.
On your slide, there was a mention of evaluation. So. In fact, Rick's asking the question, how will it be evaluated compared to current?
Talking about ISIS, right?
No, I think it was under your ontology views.
Probably. Well, that way we're doing it by based on seeing how well it works for use cases, that people have needs for views of the FMA, for example, and is it useful for them? But the
So usefulness is the evaluation.
In that particular case, there are other evaluations for the FMA. Is it consistent? Is it valid? Are there missing things? There are lots of ways with the semantic web technology to make sure that that's correct. But I argue that the fundamental evaluation of any ontology is as useful for applications. And I don't think, in general, one reason why most biologists don't know much about ontologies is they're not shown to be useful yet. There's a huge amount of work, 500 citations of the FMA, but how many of those are by biologists that are using it? So that's a challenge. And NIH is putting a lot of money to this, so why are we doing that? How can we ensure that?
So if a radiologist who uses the programs, and one who doesn't, the one who uses it is much more effective and have many more patients than the one who doesn't, that would be
one evaluation. Another one, are they more accurate? Are they using the same terminology as others so they can compare? Are they able to, one of the projects we're working with Bradlex, they generate all these textual reports. And so can you get a system to parse that language, natural language in the reports, and match the words to the words in the ontology, and in order to get a structured understanding of what's in there. So that would be an example of useful. And there, Maliha, I don't know how to pronounce your last name, in a faculty member is doing just that, natural language processing. So, but if you want to do natural language processing, you've got to have some idea what you're trying to match it to, and that's what these ontologies are. Again, these are under the hood. They should be. So these are just a summary of all the projects we've worked on. I want to get now into some of the challenges because I know there's students here, and these are, in my opinion, fantastic projects for students to work on. In FMA, a lot of challenges are this is something we're actually running a grant to do right now. How do you represent development? That is egg to the adult. We're working on that with Michael Cunningham in Children's Hospital. We're going to concentrate. The FMA initially was going to use it development. Right now, it only shows adult structures. So how could we figure out how to represent going all the way from the egg to the adult? And that's obviously more trivial. And then in addition to that, how can we add on all the developmental biology stuff, all the regulatory networks that are doing that? We're going to try to do a little bit of that in this grant. Conversion to AL2, like I said, is non-trivial, and so a lot of people need to work on that. Something called modularity. How can we make the FMA or any other large ontology so it can be developed in modules, like an engineering system? Somebody can work on the heart, somebody can work on the kidney, and they can be in another country. How do we do that? There are a lot of people trying to make that happen. So if we get it to AL2, we can start thinking about that. And again, the same thing. How do we allow multiple contributors? It seems like it should be simple, but it's not. So that's an informatics problem. Ontology views. Right now, what I actually talked about in dSparkle doesn't know anything about the semantics, doesn't know about the meaning of all this stuff. OWL ontology, web ontology language knows more about meaning, and so we want to incorporate semantics into our views. Definitely need a way to build a better user interface and utilize the results. Response time is actually a real problem, and we have a lot of good ideas about how to do that. Basically, sometimes to make some of these views, like the neuroanatomy view of the FMA, might take 5 minutes. That can't be run in real time. So how do you make that faster? Data management challenges. This is actually a thesis of Hal Lee that hopefully going to graduate soon. It's how you make a custom data management tool for little cost. That's how could you use ontologies to help you do that? Build an ontology of your data model, and then you press a button, and out comes your data management system. How to utilize standards and ontologies from the outside of data management rather than as an after effect, so that people care about managing their data. If they can have a tool that lets them manage their data and use standard terminologies, then they partially solve the data integration problem too. Data integration, how to make it easy to use, how to ensure so that things are interoperable, how to deal with privacy and security, which none of our systems deal with, but this is a huge problem for other systems like the CAD. Scalability, how to make it wider over the world wide web, how to make it faster, integrated with larger efforts like CAD. And then, again, usability is always a big problem. Visualization, how do we integrate with other tools? Content creation means kind of getting a little bit with what Marcin was talking about. How do we get it so we can extract 3D models out of real-time actual radiology images of real patients and then merge them into a canonical model? That is a very hard problem. How do we even get it to get any kind of models? This requires 3D segmentation, and that's image understanding. And then this is always comes up. How do we make it usable? And now I'm just going to briefly, these are all some of the funding that we've had over the years, and actually most of them are happening right now. But mostly they're little tiny things, and so I'd love to get something bigger because there's probably too many little pieces that are going together there. And these are a lot of, I think I've mentioned almost everybody here. I just want to, even though he's not here, I just want to give a lot of credit to Cornelius Ross, who really founded all this stuff. And then the other people who have been involved over the years. So the question I guess I always end up with, are we really getting there or not? When I first started this 20 years ago, or wherever it was, I thought the structural information framework was going to be 3D images. I now think it's the FMA. It's the foundation model anatomy. The deeper and the richer idea of structure. And we can attach images, we can attach genes, we can attach anything to it, but it's that FMA. So that's something we would like to continue on. And there are lots of interesting challenges there. Okay. 10 minutes. Any questions? In the, I don't know how the point is to say I'm 5-0.
Well, technically now, okay. But no, it's not clear that there are people beating down the door. So why don't you take a few questions? And start to come in,
then
we'll know that there's a class to follow.
Any questions? If not, I'll
switch. So if I had a research domain and I was looking for an ontology, how would I go about that?
I would go to BioPortal at Stanford. They have a whole list of all these things. Okay. It's still not that easy to find one specifically. But you can, it's got, I don't know how many. Over, anybody know how many they have? That's a lot.
I think 200 and something.
Yeah. That's where most things are gathered right now. How you use it is another question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, again, I'd like to get back to some of the issues that have to do with education, the educational framework, and how do beginning practitioners get a picture of the framework of what FMA has built. FMA particularly addresses conceptual content, but it also relates to the implementing technology, because that's the way it's going to get in people's hands. And yet the educational community has not addressed that. And Ben Shortlip made a comment about that in September in JAMA about the lack of link between informatics and the conceptual content of healthcare disciplines. And I'm kind of curious how your FMA project recognizes this criticality of the educational posture that really needs to get out there.
You mean how to get people to understand that what's in the FMA and how
well,
to use
yeah,
it?
Yeah, first of all, to recognize what FMA is, how it evolved to where it is now, and then where it can go, and how to get there.
Well, I still would argue that...
That's got to get in the educational framework at the very lowest levels to all health disciplines.
Actually, I would argue that it's not their problem. It's our problem. Because, in other words, the biologists, and I know there's some biologists in the room, I really appreciate them being here, they shouldn't have to understand that at all. They should be able to see the world from their point of view that they've always had. This should be the engine. They should be driving the car. This should be not visible.
Well, but they need to know that these these modules exist and that there's a level of detail that they work down through, but they've got to understand the framework that these modules, the informatics modules exist, and here's the value to them, you know, in a global sense. And that's what we have to get to faculty. And we've had several of our faculty said, well, we've got to find ways to say all of that in simple terms. Otherwise, we can't convey it to the students.
Well, they're right.
That, I'm curious how you're looking at taking this very valuable achievement and getting it postured so that people can understand what its seminal value really is and what its benefits could be.
Like I said, I argue that the FUSE part and the ISIS project, those are examples of what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, with citations, where there were 500 citations to the FMI, I would bet almost all of them were by informatics people. You know, they're the ones that already, they already know it. It's our challenge now. How do we get it so the people that don't care about it and want to use it to teach?
Well, yeah.
That's not true. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.